from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in forums next hour, Anne-Marie Slaughter's 2012 piece, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, is one of the most widely read articles in the history of The Atlantic. In her new book, Unfinished Business, she continues the conversation about work-life balance, but with a different approach. This time around, Slaughter de-emphasizes gender and instead focuses on policies that promote caregiving. We'll talk to her about what she sees as the way forward for working families, and we'll also ask her about California's new Fair Pay Act, the nation's strongest equal pay law, signed into law by Governor Brown just yesterday. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Anne-Marie Slaughter joins us for this morning's second forum hour, professor emeritus of politics and international affairs at Princeton and former dean of its Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She served under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as director of policy planning for the United States State Department, and she's currently president and CEO of New America. She authored an article back in 2012 for The Atlantic called Why Women Still Can't Have It All, and one of the most widely read articles in Atlantic's history. It focused on questions related to work-family balance. She recently published Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family, and we welcome her to this hour forum. Good morning.
I'm delighted to be here.
Pleased to have you here, and I thought maybe we'd begin by talking about that article of yours, which really changed your life and had an enormous readership, and we talked about, in fact, on this program when it came out, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, which wasn't the title you wanted.
No. In fact, the title I wanted was Why Women Can't Have It All, ... And The Atlantic thought that was too much like The End of Men, which they had published before, and they came up with this title, which rapidly got misunderstood and rapidly got, I get introduced as Anne-Marie Slaughter, the woman who says you can't have it all, and as the antithesis to Sheryl Sandberg, when actually these two things should be read together. I mean, they are not opposed. And, I actually, in the article, I complimented Sheryl Sandberg. In the book, I really talk about the importance of lean in and how important it has been. But I also talk about what happens when you tip over.
Well, you do a correction to lean in a bit in this book.
I do. Yeah. I do. But I agree with a lot of it.
Well, let's talk about what you really are putting forth in this book, which I think is a very important message. And you are a product of the 70s, grew up in the 70s, and really felt in that period that as you grew up and as you went to the State Department, we'll talk about your story. But it was you used the word heresy. It was a heresy to say that career is more important than family. And where did that go wrong? Because feminism was supposed to be all about choice. You know, if you wanted to be a mother and wanted to take care of your kids and you gave up a career, it was supposed to be okay. But somewhere along the line, it didn't turn out that way, did it?
Well, it's complicated. I think, you know, my generation was raised to believe we were the pioneers. I mean, the real pioneers were 10 years ahead of me, but that we were breaking those glass ceilings and, your value was how much could you do what a man did, how far could you rise in your career. And the view then was, well, if you did what your mother did and you were home taking care of your kids, you weren't pushing for equality between men and women. And so when I came out with my article to say, whoa, this is actually really, really hard and I've had every advantage under the sun, but even I tipped over and had to rethink. That, for many feminists, was read as you're discouraging younger women. You're saying that it can't be done. You're setting us back.
But your case was so special in so many ways. I mean, you were a professor. You were a dean. There was a lot of animus that your article created with people who thought, she's got a position and she's complaining about having to go out of state to work,
yeah.
Essentially.
That's absolutely right. And a lot of people thought that article was a complaint. It wasn't. What it was to say, I hit a tipping point and yes, mine was unusual, and you should have been able to predict it, that if you were commuting 3.5 hours away from home to work for a week, you were going to hit a tipping point. But my point was many, many, many women hit that tipping point because, you know, no matter how you try to make it work, things are unexpected. I had a teenager who really needed both parents hands-on, even though I had a very completely supportive spouse. Other people get a divorce or have a child with special needs or, you know, have to move or, you know, something happens with their extended family. And the point of the article was this, it's much harder than it looks to actually combine work and family for women or for men. And we still need to make all these changes so that when people hit tipping points, they aren't knocked out of the leadership track. They're not that's at the high end. At the bottom end, people lose their jobs when they hit a tipping point. If their kid is sick and they can't go in or if they have to sort of, you know, put work and family together.
How much of this, though, is gender connected? And I ask that question because you think of these single mothers who are working as waitresses. We've done shows about this.
Yep.
A kid gets an earache.
Absolutely.
They have to take one day off. They
yep.
lose their
and
job,
lose their
that
job.
Sort of thing. And yet your husband did an article. You mentioned your husband, Andrew, did an article in The Atlantic where he said, men have to be the caregivers here, too. It has to be shared. So you get into social policy. Shouldn't social policy be gender equivalent?
Yes, absolutely. And part of what I'm saying is this isn't a women's problem. This is a work problem. This is the problem of a workplace that it still assumes leave it to beaver families, that still assumes that somehow June Cleaver is out there at home. And so when the kid gets sick or, the school calls and there's a field trip or there's a snow day, maybe not in California, but in the rest of the world where, you know, the school closes, but your job doesn't. All those things that happen, the workplace assumes somebody is home. And actually, 60% of American women are in the workplace, 70% of mothers, and men, also 50% of men feel real stress because of work and family. The workplace has to make room for care. And if they don't, they're losing talent. They're losing talent. They're losing their investment. And they're just not adapting to the reality of Americans' lives.
There's a cultural factor to this, though. Well, a couple of cultural factors. One that comes immediately to mind is the fact, what I call my cousin Thelma's theorem, which is that when there's a crisis, it's the wife who is called, the mother who is called.
Yes.
And in so many cases that, especially a health crisis,
right.
That's a problem. But maybe even a deeper cultural element of this has to do with the fact that what you write about as kind of hierarchical attitude toward positions and jobs. I mean, when you went to work at the State Department, that's the big time. You're in Washington and you're running a whole policy operation under Secretary of State Clinton. This is a much bigger job. How could you give that up was really sort of the equation where many people were concerned.
Yes.
I wanted to say, who cares what these people think? You know, you want to be with your kids, be with your kids. But, you know, that's just me reacting to it. But the real sense that you argue is that, there's this hierarchical attitude and people are very ingrained with it. It's cultural.
Yes. That fundamentally what I say in the book is that I went home and if I said to people, you know, they say, why are you back? And if I said, well, you know, after 2 years in Washington, if you don't come back to the university, you lose your public service, you lose your tenure. Then everybody got it, right? Because who was going to give up a lifetime job? But if I said to people, I came back because we've got two teenagers at home and this is the last 4 years they'll be at home, essentially people looked at me and I could see them devaluing. You know, they were basically looking at me and saying, I guess she's not really a player. Because a player wouldn't choose your family when you have the chance to advance. And that is it's just wrong. It's wrong from a national, cultural, social point of view. We need to invest in the next generation. But it's also wrong individually because, you know, if you have children, you should be able to spend time with them and get the value that you get from spending time with them and still have a chance to advance when you're ready. And that's the biggest part of this argument. It's like, yeah, okay, I made that choice. But the fact that I made that choice doesn't mean that I should be any less considered for big jobs when I'm ready. And that goes for all women and for men.
Well, you use the word frequently, value. And we're talking about value that maybe could be put in terms pecuniary or fiscal, if you will. You know, there's capital and asset in raising kids.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny. The one place that really seems to get this is the Pentagon. The Pentagon has on-site daycare, and they pay early educators the same as they pay other, high school and elementary school teachers, because they know that investing in the next generation is critical to our national security, to our economy. I mean, it's what makes a society go.
Who would have thought? Sliding scale for providing child care in the Pentagon, national model for child care in the Department of Defense. But actually, speaking of national models, you know, California just passed its Fair Pay Act, and I'm interested to get your response to this. This is big news. It was just signed yesterday. It's a landmark decision signed yesterday by Governor Brown. And what it means is paying an amount close to the gender wage gap and making sure, you know, you want to look at the wages of this other person who's operating and working for this company, look at them, and then you make your case. And it has to be equitable.
Yeah, I think it's terrific. And the example that I've seen is that before, if a cleaner wanted to challenge that she was getting paid less than a man, she had to prove that they were doing exactly the same. Now a hotel maid can say, I'm doing the same work as the janitor who, cleans the lobby. Why aren't you paying me the same? So I think it's very important. It also goes to what I call the motherhood penalty, because actually, if you look at men and women who don't have caregiving obligations, they are making nearly equal pay, 92% to 96% on the dollar. But women who have caregiving obligations, the mothers, are making like 72% on the dollar. So this is a very important step forward.
Actually, we do have a cut from Governor Brown speaking about this. He was at the Rosie the Riveter National Park in Richmond at the signing of this California Fair Pay Act. And the new law will allow women to ask for equal pay for similar work. You may want to think about how you define similar work here. That gets into some subjectivity, but that's regardless of the job title.
This is really a big day, important. The inequities that have plagued our state and have burdened women for forever are slowly being resolved with this kind of bill. And by the way, it's not over yet.
That's the strongest equal pay protection for women in the nation right now here in California, where sometimes we even do have snow. We're talking to Anne-Marie Slaughter, who is president of New America Foundation. They're, by the way, a nonprofit think tank, and she's the author of Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family. She'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6:30. And let's talk about, what might be a national model for women and men where the workplace is concerned. And I think we're talking – well, let me ask you first. Would you have left the job if your adolescent son, had gone been, well, troubled?
If he had not been in trouble. You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't know. What I do know is that when I went home – he straightened out. I don't think that was just me. I don't think that's fair to my husband, who was the lead parent and was doing a really good job. I'll never know, but I know I made the right choice. What I then did decide in 2012, I could have put my hat back in for another foreign policy job and gone back to Washington. And I wanted to, but at that point, I did look at both my children and say, this is it. This is the last 4 years that they will be at home. And I don't want to look back at the end of my life and think that I missed that.
Well, your younger kid asked to draw you, drew a laptop. I mean, that was pretty revealing in itself.
Yeah, I mean,
so much at your computer that wasn't you at a laptop. You were the laptop.
I was the laptop. I mean, that was the point. I've always worked, right? I've always worked hard, but I've always managed to be the kind of parent I wanted to be. But yes, both my kids would say they competed with screens for my husband's and my attention.
Well, you worked for Hillary Clinton, who's likely to be the Democratic nominee, and she's all in favor of paid family and medical leave. She made it a centerpiece of her campaign. But really what you're proposing in this book, it seems to me, is far beyond that. It's more like what we see in Denmark or in France or Holland or Sweden, major role for government. And with respect to, let's say, the present Congress, the likelihood of getting that kind of legislation through, you seem pretty optimistic, despite the fact that Republicans have been pretty much naysayers on this score.
Well, I'm heartened by the fact that Republicans supported this Pay Equity Act here in California. That's a very good
Democratic-dominated legislature.
Okay, but still, there was Republican support and business support. So I'm not sure that's true. I would say I am asking for exactly what Hillary Clinton is fighting for, which is paid leave. That is essential, and we are making real progress on paid leave now. D.C. just introduced a 16-week paid leave bill. Cincinnati in Ohio just adopted paid leave. I'm in New Jersey with a Republican governor, and we have paid leave. So I want paid leave. I want maternity and paternity leave, and I want access to quality child care. And there are many different ways to do that. You can do that. You know, there is a Republican version. Marco Rubio just put out a plan, and there are Democrat versions. But I don't think we're going to become Scandinavia. That is, I mean, I'm realistic enough to know that. What I am saying is we have to provide the same kind of basic infrastructure for caregivers that we do for our businesses. And that's not a women's issue. That's a work issue. It's a middle class issue. And without it, we really, you know, Americans can't both care for those they love, and that's parents as much as kids, right? The baby boom's becoming an elder boom. And they frankly can't work as productively as they could if they knew their loved ones were being cared for or they had time to care for them.
The same Congress that wants to defund Planned Parenthood?
But that's a very specific issue. That same Congress, the Republican candidates know that they have to appeal to women voters. And frankly, as this country changes demographically, you've got many more Latinos, many more South Asians, East Asians. These are all cultures with extended families who really do believe not only in caring for children, but for caring for elders. So I think the demographics are with us.
And what about, again, the cultural sense of this? There's a kind of undergirding. We've talked a great deal about this on this program that says that people in the workplace now are utterly much more dispensable than they used to be. And a lot of that has to do with, of course, the new economy, the global economy and so forth. But the attitude is prevalent, maybe even ubiquitous.
Yeah. So there are really big issues here that I don't address, right? The basic question of why middle-class wages have not risen in real terms since the 1970s is a huge issue. The kind of economy we're heading into where people wonder, will we have any minimum wage jobs at all? Or will they all be automated and you'll only have, higher-end jobs? Those are big, big questions that I cannot answer and certainly don't answer in this book. I do think, though, we are in many ways reinventing the workplace because we can because of different kinds of technology. And that, again, men as well as women want to be able to be actively engaged with their families and have meaningful work. And that there are lots of different ways we're sort of moving toward that. And, the California economy is quite different than other states. But that my proposition is allowing people to be caregivers actually makes them more productive. It lets them stay in the job. And those workplaces that just burn people out, they win in the short term, but they lose in the long term.
One of your kids, I remember, said to you, "Mom, you're a role model."
Yeah.
And I would say at this point, maybe your husband, Andrew, is placing himself as a role model. I read the article he wrote in The Atlantic. He says, "Why I put my wife's career first."
Yep.
And you tell us why that's important for men to believe they should put their wives' careers first?
Well, he says he put my career first because I was more ambitious than he was and I had the bigger job. And that, to be really support me, that's what he had to do. He had to be the lead parent. But he also says, and we have heard this from lots and lots of men who've been writing him, he says it was good for his marriage. It was. It was good for the kids. He's been a very good parent. He parents very differently than I do. He's tougher than I am in a lot of ways, but it's been very good for the boys.
Who cooks better?
What?
Who cooks
He's
better?
He's a much better cook.
That's what I thought.
Because
okay.
I multitask.
Yeah.
And cooking is – it's hard to be cook and multitask at the same time.
But you're right about going back to cooking and how much you enjoyed cooking, but it sounded like maybe
he
had the
better.
Advantage.
He's better. I was the breakfast cook there. But the other thing Andy would say, and this is what lots of men have been writing, is how good it's been for him. that he has a relationship with our sons that is so much deeper than his father had with him. And we've had men writing in. One guy said he quit his job when he realized that the growth potential of his kids was much higher than the growth potential of his company. And that, you know, he's investing in his kids and he has this tremendous relationship with them. And we've heard from military men who say, you know, I'm the lead parent because my wife is deployed, or I'm the lead parent because I was deployed and now it's her turn. So I think this is actually something men want much more than they've been able to say. And that, you know, he's standing up to say, I'm a man, believe me, he's absolutely a man, but he has a great job, but he also has this central role in the family.
Men remain very divided on this, though. And of course, women are very divided, too. How did you answer that voice in you that said, this is what I want to do. I want to be with my family, but everything indicating you should climb up the ladder here. You should go to the top. You should move forward.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is every couple needs to figure this out for themselves. And the example I give is a same-sex couple where they have to just decide, you know, who is going to be more the breadwinner and who's more the caregiver and how they're going to balance that. And in my case, I have a kind of drive that I was born with. I mean, there's nothing I can do about it. It's just the way I am. And I know that I am ultimately happier, you know, when I'm reaching for things and advancing my career. But I absolutely want to live each period of life as fully as I can. And this period with my children and at some point with my parents is equally important to me. So the way we worked it out, I have been a very active parent. I just, you know, I travel more than he does and I have bigger jobs than he does. So he has to be that anchor at home.
And let me mention that the links to your husband's article as well as your 2012 article are on our website and people can obviously access those. What about poor women or poor men for that matter? I mean, you've been working with policy for years now and, you know, have really given this a great deal of thought and reflection. I think about all those single mothers, for example. I remember reading Lenore Wiseman's work,
yeah,
which you're probably familiar with.
I know her. It's fabulous work. Yeah,
it is. And it had quite an impact on me to think because, you know, the numbers were there. It's real poverty we're talking about.
Absolutely.
With single mothers. And they can't afford child care. It's
absolutely
impossible for them. And as we said earlier, you can miss one day of work and boom, you're gone.
Yep. You know, that is probably the biggest change from the article to the book, which was in the article I was looking at, why are there too few women at the top, which is what many of us have been looking at. And, you know, why do we only have 29 women in the Fortune 500 CEOs? I now think we have to look not only at why there are too many women at the top, but why there are too few women at the top, but why there are far too many women at the bottom. The poorest members of our society are single mothers who have to be caregivers and breadwinners both. The majority of minimum wage workers are women. 2/3 of shift workers are women. This, you know, the women's movement, we have to expand these issues beyond wealthy white women. And I am relative to the rest of society in that position. But that can't be what the women's movement's about. It's got to be for all women. And, you know, women in my position—
How does it be inclusive? That's really what you're arguing.
It is. I mean, women in my position can buy our way out of a lot of these problems.
Yeah.
But the women at the bottom, as you said, you know, if you are a minimum wage worker and your child has a fever for 3 days in a row and you have to be home, you can lose your job. So that is why there are these policy recommendations, and that's why I think we should all be pushing and voting for paid leave and child care and maternity and paternity leave.
Well, we're coming up on a break. We asked our listeners on social media, suppose you have the power to set policy, what would you do to help working parents? James writes, more job security in a 6-hour workday.
Yep.
Another listener tweets, number one issue, affordable housing, especially here in the Bay Area. And Monique writes, I think all employers of women should have child care on site. If I know my child is safe, then I'm a better employee and more productive.
Absolutely.
And you can join us now. We invite your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Welcome your involvement. Welcome hearing from you. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Please join the program. We're talking Anne-Marie Slaughter. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Anne-Marie Slaughter is with us. In 2012, she published a piece in the Atlantic Monthly called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. One of the most widely read articles in the history of that magazine. And in her new book, Unfinished Business, she continues the conversation about work-life balance, but with a different approach. This time around, she de-emphasizes gender and instead focuses on policies that promote caregiving. And we're talking to her about how about her popular article and how it changed her thinking and what she sees is the way forward for working families. We do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Especially would like to hear from those of you who have worked out some kind of balance we're not necessarily here to give fresh advice about how you can compensate or work out the imbalances or do something about them to ameliorate them, but I'm really interested in hearing from people who feel that they've got a hold on this and what they've been able to do. And also the big problem that I raised toward the end of the hour, what to do to make this more inclusive, to really include those who are down in the bottom of the economic brackets who find themselves, as Anne-Marie put it, not only in the role of caregivers and caretakers in many instances, of course, but also having to be employees and be employees and with expectations that they be there all the time. Again, the book is called Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family. And to remind you, she'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6:30. Let me go to you, Cindy. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Enjoyed the show. I just wanted to make a comment as sort of being on the senior end of this, as someone who, quote-unquote, opted out. I never really wanted to stay home full-time with my kids. But it was never negotiable. It was all or nothing. And I feel that that really hasn't changed in a quarter of a century. And the other comment I wanted to make, and I'd like to ask for the speaker's comments on this, is it is almost impossible to segue back in after you've been out. It's like a red flag on your resume. If you've decided to put your kids ahead of your career, it's just one of those things, especially, ironically, women interviewers. I could get through a process with a younger male and then get to the next interview stage, and then it was almost always a woman who had second thoughts, which is very ironic. Anyway, that's my comment and my question is what your feelings are about that issue.
Anne-Marie Slaughter.
Yeah. So I'm so glad that you raised both issues. On the first one, in the book I quote this sociologist in New York, Pamela Stone, who wrote a whole book about women who, quote unquote, had opted out or dropped out. And Cindy, it's just what you said. Most of them had been shut out. Most of them wanted to keep working, but their workplace simply would not allow them to work in a way that allowed them to raise their children at the same time. And so it wasn't that they wanted to be home full time. They wanted still to be in the workplace, and it was their employers who were too rigid. And as I said, employers are losing talent that way because these are talented people who you've trained, and then you shut them out. The way to do it is to keep people in, and that goes to your second question, because it's much easier to stay in on a project basis, on a part-time basis, on a flexible basis, and then when your kids are gone to ramp back up than to get back in. Because getting back in, this is just flat-out discrimination against caregiving. It's the assumption that if you've spent your time raising children, an incredibly important thing, you just aren't committed enough to be worth hiring again, or your skills are too rusty, when in fact, there are all sorts of things that caregiving teaches you that makes you much better in the workplace. And I go into this in the book. But also, you've got what I call phase three. You've got 10 to 15 years of really productive work there. And some of the big banks, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, now have what they call returnship programs, where they're specifically looking for women just in your position and helping them get back in. But the last thing to say is I agree. I think women, many women feel like, well, if you dropped out, you weren't, you know, you weren't really, you didn't have the fire in the belly you need. And my point is that that's just wrong. You can have ambition in the workplace and ambition to be a fully engaged parent at the same time.
Too many instances, it's almost like being an ex-con or something, you know, that's on your jacket and you can't erase it. Thank you for that, Cindy. Good to hear from you. I want to hear from another caller, and that's Jasmine. Jasmine, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, so I actually was calling. I kind of stumbled upon this radio station. I got a zip car, and then it was just on this radio station, but I didn't catch your name.
It's Anne Marie Slaughter. The guest is Anne Marie Slaughter.
Slaughter. Yeah.
And
yes,
and keep stumbling, Jasmine.
Yeah. We're glad. We're glad you did.
I wanted to commend you on really trying to focus on policy that's very inclusive of different people's identities. I'm a student. I'm 22 years old, but I also have a 2-year-old. I attend Mills College in Oakland. And we have conversations around gender and around intersectionality of different identities. And especially this semester, I've been finding it very troubling to balance childcare and days where my child is sick or can't go to school and where I have to be in class. And, you know, like, I was wondering, are there ways that, you know, and I go to an all-women's college as well, but it seems that that really doesn't even matter because the daycare on our campus is $20,000 for the year.
Jeez.
And that's half of my tuition. And it's ridiculous, you know, and right now I'm also, like, receiving state benefits and things like that. So I find that, like, a lot of times it's a struggle being a parent and also trying to even get up to the next bracket. And it's troubling to know that, you know, in the next coming decade, jobs that are minimum wage or jobs that don't necessarily require you to have a degree are going to be very, like, you know, hard to find and also very hard to keep if you do have a family and if you make the choice to, you know, put your children first before education or work.
Yeah, Jasmine, you know? I'm glad you called because you stumbled upon some important issues here. Yeah.
No, you absolutely did. And you know, it's interesting. A number of women wrote to me after my article and said just what you just said, that they were trying to get the kind of education that they need to get the better jobs that will actually allow them to advance. And that universities, you know, assume that you are between 18 and 22 and you have no family whatsoever. And that is clearly not true. And particularly, you know, there are 40% of women in this country are the primary breadwinner, and a large proportion of those are single moms. And unless we can allow you to take classes and have your child taken care of, we're not giving you the leg up that you need. The other thing I will say is daycare costs more than rent in all 50 states.
And in many instances, daycare doesn't even equal the amount of pay that the job
not
has.
At all.
And
not at all.
Thank you for that call again, Jasmine. We're going to get another caller on here. Leif, welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just this may be the stilted male perspective here, but you know, I'm an old guy, and about 40 years ago, we spent a lot of time trying to open up some areas that had traditionally been male jobs to females. And in my particular case, I'm talking about the trades and construction. But there really are today. Still almost no women in the trades, and all those jobs pay well. And that would be just a wonderful way to wipe out this pay inequity. If you're actually doing the same job, it makes it very difficult to pay a different amount. But women in general have not applied, and I think that they're missing a good boat there.
Thank
Point
you.
Well taken.
Yeah, no, that's very good. And, you know, there may be many reasons for that, that women still worry about a hostile work environment. I certainly have heard women. There was a woman who owns a construction company in Chicago who I talked to, who said, you know, she was a rare bird, and that lots of women, I think, worry that that's not a good work environment. But I hear you completely. Those are the kinds of jobs that should be open to women and men. All I would say there is, though, that may also mean that some of the men who are currently in those jobs are going to have to take a bigger role at home. And that's a big culture change, because a lot of those guys may want to be home more with their kids, but may really worry about, you know, how they're perceived. And part of my point is, you know, guys are missing out. Guys should be able to be, as I said, as active with their families as women are active in, as breadwinners.
When you talk about work environments not being receptive necessarily to women, though, I can't help thinking about a program we did with a woman police officer who went into the whole history of how, I mean, a male-dominated police force did not want women, but now look at the changes that have occurred.
Absolutely. They're great.
Some pushback on Facebook from a listener says, isn't parent flexibility in the workplace unfair to those who choose not to have children? Those people can devote more time to their work, and they should be rewarded.
Yes, and that, I'm so glad that we got that question. So the first thing to say is, look, we want this to be about choice. So many of us do choose, you know, to work differently. I talk about it in terms of intervals, going hard and then slowing down while we have kids. We should not be promoted as fast as the people who go all out, right? My point is not that everybody should be treated exactly the same. It's just saying that, like our first caller, Cindy, if you do decide that you want to work part-time or work flexibly because you want to be a fully engaged parent or because you're taking care of your parents or anybody else, then you shouldn't be knocked out of the workplace. But yes, the people who decide work is what they want to devote themselves to should rise faster. And they should also be able to take advantage of flexible policies, because there's self-care in there. There's working in your community. There's a whole bunch of things that I actually think people will be more productive in the workplace if they've got the chance to do more than work.
Got to read a tweet from a listener who writes, Pentagon funding daycare isn't leading policy. It's proof of the luxurious over-budgeting of the U.S. military-industrial complex.
Well, I would say that since the Pentagon has men and women now in the Pentagon, they are deciding, just as one of our callers said, that their workers are more productive when they know their kids are close by.
Let me read another tweet here from Carrie, who says, should the Child Care Development Act be reintroduced in Congress, Obama would veto like Nixon did. And that act would have provided, I guess, National Child Care Service designed to help single parents.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I say, you know, it passed both houses of a universal child care bill passed both houses of Congress with a bipartisan majority in 1971, and Nixon vetoed it, and we have not gotten back to that. But I think we've got to keep trying. I also talk about, you know, we've got 20 women senators now, and the caucus for work and family is headed by Kelly Ayotte, and she's a Republican from New Hampshire. There is, again, a sense that these are not just women's issues. These are work issues, they're middle class issues, and I would say we got to keep trying.
I'm going to read another tweet from Jamie, who says, I'm listening while feeding a 4-week-old and on paid maternity leave. My husband and I are both taking time off, but he had to negotiate his. Abby writes, as a new mom, I naively assumed that our country would have policies to support working women who are also mothers. Now I see that it's an ad hoc system. It seems that every woman and every man, too, must come up with their own system that works for their family. Fortunately, I have a wonderful employer, supportive co-workers, a great husband, and access to high-quality child care. But I know that is mostly a matter of luck. Wouldn't we all be better off if our society worked together on this issue rather than leaving families to craft their own solutions? And Laura writes online, thank you, Anne-Marie Slaughter, for fighting for government policies that support families. It's so crucial to the survival of the middle class. Jennifer says, it's not about work-life balance that suggests a zero-sum game where you take from one to give to the other. Instead, I suggest work-life harmony. Multiple notes played together make a chord, which we call music. Sometimes one note is louder than the others, and you often have multiple players. Okay, not to belabor the metaphor, but as a woman, a mom, a worker, I believe harmony is possible. And Pete tweets us, I guess tipping point is an appropriate term for those who are trying to balance it all, an impossibility after all.
So I want to address that last issue, because in the book I say, let's just get rid of having it all, period, the end. It's not about having it all. It is about being people who have, you know, can care for the people we love and do good, our work well. And it's for all of us. That's why I say we really have to have an entire set of policies that support everybody. The one thing I will say, the first tweet is very important, that the woman who said, you know, my husband had to negotiate his paternity leave. This is part of what's happening. that the good companies that have policies for women don't have them for men. And that pushes men who want to be equal parents back into traditional gender roles.
We do have it here at KQED, I want to say with some pride.
You know. That's important.
One of our lead players just had paternity leave and the beautiful young son. Let me go to our callers and we'll go to Suzanne next. Suzanne, you're on.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Thank you so much for your work. I'm a very big fan and for your courage as well. I just wanted to share an experience of taking a high-level position on a USAID project where I had to be based out of the country and took the decision to leave my family behind, mainly because I was under a lot of pressure for a major deliverable and on an airplane every 2 days, and we figured it was more disruptive to bring kids into that equation. But I have to say, although I was working in an international community and with people I would have thought had a more open mind about coming without my family, I found myself constantly scrutinized and judged by my male colleagues for, quote-unquote, leaving my children behind.
Yeah.
Whereas my male colleagues never, this never seemed to be a question. And it really was really disturbing. It became a kind of, every other week, when are they coming, when are they coming question. And then I had also, upon my return, the very interesting experience of then sort of feeling judged again, but this time by female friends, acquaintances in the larger circle who kind of seemed to struggle with the decision to take a position to advance my career at this juncture. And also, you know, the decision that we thought was best for our family, which was to leave the kids at home and not disrupt them. So, I think you become a focal point and a lightning rod for everybody in a way that men still don't. And I wondered if you had some insight into how to negotiate that. Because, of course, to make the systemic policy change, we really need women to support one another in all of our decisions, whatever those are.
Yeah, this is about equality, right? I mean, it's not – balance is a luxury. Equality is a necessity. And the point – your point – you're absolutely right that we still basically assume women can work, but it is their job to raise the children. And my point is, no, women and men create children, and women and men equally are responsible for raising the children and equally responsible with care and income. And so men go all over the place with their children at home. But if you're a woman who does that, then, you know, the assumption is you're not a good mother. That's actually discriminating against the guy, because they're clearly assuming your husband can't raise the kids as well as you can. And my point is that's not true. It's up to individuals and individual couples to figure out who's got the bigger job, who's making more money, who's more ambitious, who wants to be more with the kids, those kinds of issues.
You say we both make children, but a lot of this goes back to the Western notions of the maternality and the woman is the one who bears the child and all of that tied up with women supposedly fulfilling their destiny by being mothers.
Yeah, but that's the 1950s. Well, I was raised, you know, I was told that women who are competitive couldn't get a husband, right? And I always say I got two. but you know, that's so...
Not at the same time.
No, not at the same time.
Otherwise, we do a citizen's arrest for bigamy on this spot.
But that is why I call this unfinished business. This is the unfinished business of the women's movement, which is to say, you know, you can't say women are equal as long as they do what men used to do. You have to say women and men are equal, both as parents or caregivers and as breadwinners. And that means every individual couple, or if you're not coupled, then your extended family figures out who's going to be more at home and who's going to be more in the workplace. Or, you know, in some lucky couples really can divide it 50-50, but that's often hard.
Well, I'm looking at a listener's comment online, which dovetails with something that was said earlier. This listener writes, I've been freelancing, working part-time, running my own business, and even went back to school for another master's degree after the birth of a second child. I have three total now, finally two teenagers and a fourth grader later.
Jeez.
I was able to return to work full-time just this past summer. It's harder to negotiate than I could have imagined, all of it, and the meanest people I came across, bar none, were the women managers in their 50s with no children.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of those women in their 50s with no children were pioneers, and they broke glass ceilings, and I honor their work. But my point to them is, you know, you've made the first half of the revolution. Now let's make the second half, that ultimately it's got to be possible for women to make different choices and men to make different choices and still take advantage of their talent. And, you know, you said, are there places where this works? I would tell listeners to go to openwork.org, like OpenGov and Open Data and Open Source, where there are lots of examples of companies that are letting people come back or are letting people stay in, women and men, while they have caregiving responsibilities. So, you know, for concrete examples, you want to point to your boss. There are a lot of examples out there.
I'm going to go to more callers in just a moment. What is the New American Foundation, though? What policies are you honing in on, the ones we're talking about?
Yeah, right? Well, so it's New America, and we have a big breadwinning and caregiving program that is looking at things like paternity leave and paid leave generally, but also, you know, on men as caregivers, men as lead parents. I mean, there are lots of men who are beginning to step up in various ways. Actually, if you listen to Madison Avenue, they're starting to advertise to soccer dads, right? New America does that. We also have a big foreign policy program. We do a huge amount on education, both early ed and higher education, as well as K through 12, also political reform. We're a think tank. We're big on big ideas and on how policy and technology intersect.
Need to ask you, it may sound like a little impertinent question, but it's come up in this program before, and as much as I respect Hillary Clinton, it seems to be asked over and over and over again, so I'd like to ask you. She was a wonderful boss, and you give real tribute to her, give real props to her and working for her. But it's often said that as Secretary of State, all the travel she did, she accomplished nothing they could put up in a marquee. There was supposed to be a new start with Russia. There were all kinds of things that were in the works, and here we are. I mean, what can she really advertise from her work as Secretary of State? And I say this also because we have Neil Ferguson on tomorrow talking about his book on Kissinger.
I'm happy to answer that question. I mean, in the first place, she laid the groundwork for a lot of what now, frankly, John Kerry is harvesting. I mean, without Hillary Clinton putting together the coalition to impose sanctions on Iran, you wouldn't have an Iran deal. So she did that work, and it was incredibly hard work. She also was one of the architects of, you know, the turn to Asia. And just yesterday, people may not like the trade agreement with Asia, but her point was we have to focus on strengthening our alliances with Japan, with the Philippines, with Thailand, with Southeast Asian countries. And we have to engage China, but we also have to be tough with China. And that was a lot of Hillary Clinton's work. She did, you know, if you read her book, there's many deals that she negotiated. There's a ceasefire with Hamas, a deal in Honduras. But, you know, she was working at a time where the world didn't present the moment to do the big deal. I mean, there are lots of secretaries of state who didn't do the big deals, and then there's some that do. That's a function of timing. She's the one that, as I would say many women do, put in a lot of the behind-the-scenes hard work that made those things possible. And the last thing I'll say is she's the first Secretary of State ever to really understand that development, that, you know, the work we do helping other countries develop and get literate, combat disease, really grow, that is as important to our foreign policy as traditional negotiating diplomacy is. And I think she's actually a visionary there. And we won't see the results of that work for decades, but she really changed the State Department.
And we do go to more of your calls. Anne, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is that a lot of the efforts to improve maternity leave and family-friendly work policies have been focused on the public sector. And here in Silicon Valley, there's a huge push right now to try and increase the number of women in science and engineering careers. But the fact is that the vast majority of those positions are actually in the private sector. And if you look at the history of the private sector regarding family-friendly policies in the Bay Area, it just doesn't exist. I've been an engineer in Silicon Valley for more than 20 years. And when I was younger, absolutely, the idea of even taking maternity leave was unthinkable. I actually did. I finally decided in my late 30s I was going to have a child. I did, and I had to quit my job.
Wow.
When I tried to re-enter the workforce, the level of discrimination was absolutely unbelievable. It was almost as if my 15 years of previous engineering experience had somehow magically disappeared because I took 1 year out of the workforce to be with my child. It took me 3 years and probably applying to over 100 jobs to re-enter my career as a design engineer. And I have one child by choice, and I still get questions as to why there's a blank spot on my resume because I decided to actually be at home with my child.
It's a very damning story, Andy.
It's extraordinary. And the first thing I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, that's just plain corporate waste. You know, all these tech companies talking about the dearth of talent, and there you are with 16 years and all that talent, and then and you take a year out to be with a child, and suddenly you're not employable. That is just waste. It's just blind, stupid policy. But what I would say to you, I hear it over and over again, and part of the reason I think we have to have this conversation, I call it flexibility stigma, because, you know, companies have policies, and then you take them, and then you're stigmatized because you took them, and you have to fight it. I think there are some changes. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg has had a big impact in terms of talking about the importance of some of these policies. There's I'm forgetting his name, but a very high guy at Facebook actually took paternity leave and wrote about it. And because part of this,
I'm going blank on his name, too.
I can't believe it. But he wrote a great piece about how important it is to take paternity leave because, as you well know, speaking to the caller, the men are going to have to do this, too. But
Tom Stocky. Thank
you,
Tina.
That's right. That's right. But the other thing I would say is, you know, all these campuses, you know, I was there yesterday at the Yahoo campus and LinkedIn and Google and Facebook, they all should have on-site daycare, right? That would make a big difference. And the kind of daycare that's high quality that you know, you could take your kids in, they would be there, and they should combine that with more flexible leave policies.
They have all those other things that you can do.
Yeah.
So you'll stay at the company.
Yes, exactly.
So even taking care of your dry cleaning, your dog, ping pong tables, pool tables, et cetera, et cetera. But childcare, that may keep you away from the company.
I would just say one more thing. I actually think that I don't want to hire people that would put, working round the clock ahead of their children. I really don't. I don't want to hire people who would say, somebody wrote me and said his boss bragged about the fact that he'd worked 80 hours that week when his wife was dying for cancer. I don't want to hire that person. I think there's something wrong with that person.
Boy, what a note to end on. Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you so much for being with us. Anne-Marie Slaughter is president of New America, a nonprofit think tank. Her book, Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family, and you can meet her this evening at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. She'll be there at 6:30 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. And we remind you that we do like to hear from you. If you have something you'd like to suggest in the way of programming or give us a response to something you've heard, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Tina Larberg, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.